We are at the Santa Fe Institute with Harold Morovitz, who's Clarence Robinson Professor of Biology and Natural Philosophy at George Mason University, former director of the Krasnow Institute for Advanced Study in Fairfax, Virginia, and a longtime associate and science board member of the Santa Fe Institute. Also the author of The Emergence of Everything, How the World Became Complex, and a series of other books, which were sort of wonderful essays about thermodynamics, the origins of life, the origin of complexity, and so on. Let's deal with this, The Emergence of Everything. It's a sort of an ambitious title, isn't it? Could you set the context
must say,
for this?
I must say, the title was the publisher's, not mine. I must confess to that. Although, having that title, I'm perfectly happy with it. That is to say, the idea of a book on emergence came to me from reading John Holland's book on emergence, in which he said, well, we sort of understand what emergence is, but we can only indicate it by examples. And so I decided to take a hierarchical series of examples going back as far in time as I could reasonably go and bringing it up as close to the present as I could reasonably come. But it's a series of pointing out emergences, which seem clearly they are emergences, meaning they are major changes in what was happening to the universe, the solar system, the planet, the life at each of these. And pointing these out as the empirical emergences. So that's the emergence of everything is really a hierarchical list of empirical emergences.
And complex adaptive systems would play, which is of course the lifeblood of this institute, would be something very sympathetic to your views, I assume.
Well, that's a way of thinking about emergences because, again, going back to John Holland's book, he would look at it from a computer scientist's point of view as being able to model a system. And you try and do a computational model and it gets much too complex to deal with. So you need pruning algorithms. And so that's how it fits into the kind of theme of the Institute. And
now, was John Holland here?
On and off over the years.
So he was well known for genetic algorithms.
Yes, but John has been a close associate of this institute ever since its founding. Right. As a matter of fact, one time way back, he and Murray Gell-Mann were chairs of the Science Advisory Committee, co-chairs of the Science Advisory Committee.
Has the view of how the world became complex shifted during the time that you've been in business as a scientist, and if so, how?
That's a kind of difficult question. The answer is clearly yes, but how is, I think we're now able to use a language that comes much closer to the social sciences, much closer to the arts than when I was a graduate student, where, you know, to talk about things like teleology or ideas like that wouldn't have been quite respectable. But then when information theory came along, the work of Wiener, Brillouin, and so forth. And
Claude Shannon.
Claude Shannon, right. And bringing all this into part of the main thrust of science. And even when the Institute here got started, it was mostly physicists thinking about other domains. Mm-hmm. Where the kind of thinking could be applied, and now it's clearly applied among all of those. I mean, I've been a biologist all of this time, and with a constant interest in the origin of life as one of the emergences. That is, when I came to speak about the emergences, then when I finished this book, then to get back to my desk and hard work, I wanted to take the emergence I thought I might be able to have some understanding of. And because of training, problems I had worked on and so forth and so on, that was the origin of life.
spent some time, as you know, at the Salk Institute, and Leslie Orgel was there, who you would have known, obviously, as somebody else who'd written extensively on prebiotic chemistry, the origins of life, and so on. What's the current, our best understanding of?
Well, there are still conflicting groups. The two major conflicting groups are the geneticists and the metabolists. We're card-carrying metabolists here. Those who thought that the underlying chemistry came first and that worked up through the metabolism, through the citric acid cycle, through the synthesis of amino acids and ribonucleotides up to living forms. Whereas the geneticists seem to think that RNA came first, the RNA being both coding and enzymatic, was able to direct everything else. But the reason we haven't followed that point of view is we don't see any firm understanding in that point of view as to where the ribonucleotides came from. Mm-hmm. And so it's, whereas we think we can trace back where the elements of the reductive citric acid cycle came from. And that requires only carbon dioxide and ammonia and hydrogen and phosphate and hydrogen sulfide, and everything else is made from those constituents. It's this buildup from simplicity to complexity that looks like the most easiest to understand point of view, and one that we think we have some hope of following through.
The whole notion of the emergence of metabolism. I think I saw a presentation that you did some years ago with Eric Smith. Could you set that up? I mean, we take it for granted, is what I'm saying. But the notion of the beginning of metabolism.
Okay. The reason we are able to do this, let me give you that first, is that there are organisms today which, starting out with carbon dioxide as the sole source of carbon, make everything else. Every other carbon compound, which is in fact every other biotic compound, is made starting with CO2. And the feeling, well, that's all you had at the beginning on the planet with respect. You know, you had some inflow of from outer space of some compounds and so forth, from comets and so forth and so on. But basically, if you look at the planet as a whole, you had carbon dioxide. And the fact that we can take that view and then we can look at organisms, our favorite has been one called Aquifex aeolicus, and you can look at that and follow through its metabolism, how it goes from carbon dioxide and builds up to everything else. And it's using that kind of pattern and then looking for all other organisms that are related to it and metabolically related to it. We feel that we're able to take the present day biology, and there are no ancient organisms on Earth today. Every organism on the planet today, even bacteria, which we tend to think of as very ancient, I have in fact changed constantly over the 4 billion year period. So, but by following through the core biochemistry of everything, we have been able to, we think, move back and get a fair view of what the earliest biochemistry was like.
So, the organism you just described?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, it comes from hot springs in Italy with the strain that we've gotten our data from. But the important thing for us is that you feed it just carbon dioxide and hydrogen and ammonia and so forth, and it makes everything else. And it has been sequenced. So we're able to find out all the enzymes, all the biochemical reactions, and we're able to construct its entire metabolism, every step of its metabolism. And that's led us to some, I shouldn't say extraordinary, some extraordinary generalities. For instance, we have the metabolic network of anabolism, which is how you build up everything. And all compounds can be traced back to five compounds in this reductive citric acid cycle. Everything is made from those five compounds. And using that as a pattern, then we looked at all other autotrophic organisms. Autotrophic meaning organisms that make everything from one carbon compounds. And we find out that this core metabolic map is the same for every autotroph. So what we've traced back to our thoughts of what the earliest metabolism was like is the first trophic level of every ecological system on the Earth today consists of that same metabolic network.
So it's a little ironic, this. I was just thinking as you were saying this and talking about the carbon dioxide and the that we now have an issue about carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases, and so on, and you're talking about an atmosphere in which things started.
At the deep oceanic trenches, carbon dioxide and hydrogen bubbled up. But the way things have covered this 4 billion years of life is extraordinary. My favorite example is there's a molecule called glutamic acid. And it's one of the core molecules in the, its precursor, alpha-ketoglutaric acid is one of the core molecules in the citric acid cycle. And then you get glutamic acid. It goes back 4 billion years, and it's the molecule by which all nitrogen enters through ecosystems by combination with glutamic acid. So it's really important. 4 billion years later, glutamic acid is one of our chief neurotransmitters.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, one begins to think there's... No, I'm not spooky about this, but one begins to think that there's certain extraordinary generalities that are working their way through all of biology, certainly through all of biochemistry.
I thought for a moment you were going to say there was a plan there or something.
It's extraordinary that over 4 billion years this molecule has had three extraordinarily different functions from the most primitive to the most complex.
You know, if you're an expertise in the origins of life and chemistry of the origins of life, then obviously you have had and have been called publicly to talk about these issues in some of the science versus religion, intelligent design issues, and so on. So could you give me some sort of a sense of what happened?
My most exciting event was when I was a professional witness at the Little Rock Creation Science, Evolution Science trial. And that was kind of extraordinary. And it consisted of having to teach a federal judge about the second law of thermodynamics, which he was very good at learning, I must say. And
which version did you give him of the second law? There's no free lunch, or?
No, the version I gave him is life has no contradiction to the laws of thermodynamics because there's a constant increase of entropy from the entropy flowing into the Earth from the Sun and out as heat to outer space. And if you look at the calculations on those flows, you get a large increase of entropy. So if there's a local decrease on the surface of the planet accompanying that large universal increase, there's no violation of the second law. Mm-hmm. So organization does not violate the second law. Local organization does not violate the second law. So,
and the testimony was what was involved. It was conveying the sense of what the second law was doing.
Right, and because part of the argument on the part of the creationists was that life violated the second law, and But it was quite a trial. The judge would only allow 5 professional witnesses from each side. And there were Steve Gould and myself and Francis Ayala and Michael Roos and another gentleman who was an expert on radioactive aging, whose name skips my mind at the moment. But it was kind of exciting. And the outcome of that case has been the standard case by which all subsequent such cases have been judged. And
what's your sense of how that debate has unfolded over there?
I think what really came out of what he was saying, of the judge's opinion, and what we were all saying, was that there was a scientific theory, and there were others, but they had religious sources. And therefore, to teach them in the public schools violated the First Amendment. So wherever this has come before the courts, it's been the issue of the First Amendment.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, what do you have of a sense at the moment of the state of science education? The reason I mention this is that on the one hand, you have a president saying that he wants to restore science to its rightful place. On the other hand, we're at the 50th anniversary of C.P. Snow's Two Cultures. A book has just came out from science writer called Chris Mooney and his colleague Shel Kirshenbaum called Unscientific America, which bemoans the state of scientific literacy.
Where 50% of the people don't believe in evolution.
Right. What's the fundamental issue here? Because you've been communicating science for a long time.
The number of people who have a firm scientific education is fairly small. One is working at that. Exciting thing that happened here this summer is through the Santa Fe Institute, a summer school for middle and high school science teachers was run, 2 weeks summer session. And those of us who, it was part of our National Science Foundation project on the origin of life. It was our outreach activity for the year. And we actually had a number of the research scientists talking to the high school and middle school science teachers. And it was really extraordinarily successful. They really appreciated the chance to interact with the scientists. And it's somewhat cynical. I was surprised at how eager the scientists were to devote time to interacting with this group. So it was, not only did we talk to them, we had lunch with them, and it was quite an extraordinary 2 weeks.
There was a report came out recently from the Pew Research Center, which polled unusually. They just go and poll a general audience and find out what they know about science, what they think about science. In this instance, they polled also members of the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, to find out what their sense was of the bridge building between scientists and it was not terribly optimistic in the sense that. There are obviously a lot of gaps in the information that people had in general. But there was also seemed to be some sort of reluctance of scientists to actually communicate what they were all about, as if it was not something that they should necessarily be doing.
I've always been in favor of communicating science. The fact of the matter is the public pays for it. 90% of science is on federal, I don't know what percentage, but a high percentage is on federal grants and all sorts of activities like that. And so I think it's our obligation to share that knowledge with the public. As a matter of fact, an idea that came out of this meeting, which I'll take advantage of this opportunity, that we came up with, we thought it should be the obligation of every major research university to have researchers give talks to local high school and middle school science teachers, so that to keep up that idea of sharing the opportunity for the two groups to communicate with each other.
How did you, sometimes this is, a lot of this involves what happens to you when you're a kid and so on. How did you get into science in the first place? Did you have a scientific parent or?
No, it's hard to trace it back, but I can't remember exactly how old I was, but at a very young age I had a workbench in the basement that I had jars of chemicals that I was mixing and so forth and so on. It came very early.
Where were you living that time?
In Poughkeepsie, New York. And from reading, there was a series of books, which I think my mother must have gotten when she was younger, called the Haldeman Julius Little Blue Books. Are you familiar with that? They were extraordinary. They were about 3 by 5 inches, 50 to 75 pages. They cost 10 cents. And they were such titles as Darwin and Evolution, The Trial and Deaths of Socrates, all sorts of, and they were bestsellers, I guess, in sort of 1915 to 1930. And my mother had a whole collection of these in a shelf in the house. And I spent a lot of my childhood reading those. And, you know, it's hard to say where these things come from, but that's one of the things I can remember.
Then the chemistry set, or the messing with chemicals.
Yeah, it became a chemistry set as soon as I could put enough money together.
Well, would you regard yourself as having been a chemist, or, I mean?
No, it was everything. It was chemistry, it was astronomy, it was biology.
You've written, I mean, several books on entropy, though, and on thermodynamics.
Right.
One was, I'm trying to remember if there was a title, it was something like Thermodynamics and Pizza, or Entropy and
Pizza.
Well, I
should say I've written two kinds of books. One are a series of essays. I used to write a monthly essay for a magazine called Hospital Practice. And it was most of the readers are MDs, but the essays were on science and society. So that gave me a chance to write about anything that I wanted. So those books, the books with the weird titles, the titles are picked from the titles of one of the essays in the book. So those are collections of essays. That's where the thermodynamics of pizza and mayonnaise and the origin of life and so forth come from. But then I've written a book on entropy for biologists, energy flow in biology, and the foundations of bioenergetics. And those are straightforward scientific textbook monograph type books on thermodynamics and biology.
Yeah. I mean, we're here for a meeting, a workshop on aging.
Right.
That's energy, that's thermodynamics, ultimately, it's true. I mean, did you ever get interested in that part of it, the whole notion of biology of senescence and so on and so forth?
How to avoid it? No, I guess I'm interested in the origin of life that took place about 4 billion years ago, so I feel I'm on my end of the emergence curve. The other end I'll let other people worry about.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts about how more effectively to create a more literate scientific culture, how to have people think like scientists, perhaps?
Well, again, just some specific things that have happened really through. We have a grant here called From Geochemistry to the Genetic Code with is a total of 5 institutions. SFI, George Mason, University of Colorado, University of Illinois, and Carnegie Institute of Geophysics. As part of our group, one is obligated to NSF to try and get ways of spreading what you're doing out to the broader public. And we were fortunate to meet up with a group arranged through the Santa Fe Institute at New Mexico Highlands University with a group of students who are art students who worked out a museum display on the origin of life. Mm-hmm. And that's been very successful. It actually got to be displayed in the atrium of the National Science Foundation in Virginia for a few weeks, 1 year. So again, that was one which we happened upon but wouldn't have thought of in advance, but that is a kind of activity whereby students from an arts domain who learned a lot of science along the way to put the exhibit together. So there was that activity. But what I would focus on now is I think just because I see ways to do it, I think this idea of researchers talking to science teachers. Because science teachers, most of them have never met a researcher. Mm-hmm. They're good high school science teachers, they're well educated and so forth, but they've never actually met a researcher to ask them, you know, what do you do and how does it work and so forth and so on. And I have this question I've always wanted to ask. And so I think that's an activity. If I am able to devote some more time to this in the next year or so, as a matter of fact, as soon as I get back to my home institution, which is George Mason University, I want to start encouraging that activity of research scientists giving lectures, seminars, other kinds of group activities for high school teachers.
Do you actually have any scientific heroes yourself? Is there anybody, even in history, that you'd love to have had a chance to sit down and have a conversation with?
Probably Josiah Willard Gibbs.
Gibbs?
Gibbs. Who was the founder of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics.
I thought you'd have said Boltzmann, but...
Well, he would have been second.
All right.
One of my books called Entropy and the Magic Flute, that essay tells about trying to find the Boltzmann tombstone with the entropy formula S equals K log W on when I was wandering through Vienna once. And I did find it. The reason for the magic flute is the people at the various tourist places would say, what are you looking for? We don't know who Boltzmann is. Go to the Mozart Memorial.
Go and do something useful. Who is this guy?
Right. But actually, Gibbs, in one of my books, Foundations of Bioenergetics, it's dedicated to some teachers who have made a lot of difference to me. And it starts out actually with my high school general science teacher and ends up with the ghost of Josiah Willard Gibbs.
So there was a high school science teacher.
Sometimes, yes.
So particularly that turned you on to, well, at least
confirmed. No, I was interested in science anyway.
Confirmed your sense, though.
But he was just very encouraging.
Tell me the story of Boltzmann's, the great, what was the story there?
Well, so I had read that on his tombstone was this S equals K log W, and being in Vienna, I wanted to see it. So I started wandering around to tourist places saying, where is the Boltzmann tombstone? And no one knew of it. And then one woman was directing me to the Mozart Memorial. But finally, I did find one tourist place that had a book of everything. And they directed me to the Central Cemetery in Vienna, where incidentally, people are buried by their professions. So all the scientists are together, all the musicians are together. It's quite extraordinary. And of course, Vienna in that period of the 1800s, early 1900s, had produced so many people in all these areas. So I wrote down Boltzmann and so forth, and I showed it at the guard at the cemetery, who was looked saw the B and was pointing me over to Beethoven. And no, I said Boltzmann and Wissenschaftlicher, and so he did point me to where the it's neck the scientists are. It's the two. You mentioned something about the two worlds, the two cultures.
Two cultures, yeah.
Yes,
this was in Snow's thing. This was one of his.
Yeah, I've read Snow's book. Yeah,
right.
But if you want to go. Go to the Central Cemetery in Vienna and see the musicians and the
even in death.
And the scientists. They happen to be next to each other. Those two sections of the cemetery. Yeah.
But this was Snow's test case, wasn't it? He was saying that.
If you don't know about the second law, it's like not having read Shakespeare, as I remember Snow. Yes. And he's right. After all, the famous Little Rock case on the science and creation did depend on knowing the second law.
Yeah. What was the most? What do you think has been the most remarkable piece of science during your memory? What has stuck out in your memory as being just a remark? DNA, 1953. What really do you think has
been
a major?
Well, certainly DNA and the code and all of that. And again, I'm just saying how it's affected me, not how I think it's affected the world. Information theory was another one because that led us to try and think about information theory and biology, and that was important. Stanley Miller experiment on the early making biological type compounds
by random
synthesis.
Yeah.
Well, was another important one, but of course there've been so many of them. I think the thing that has changed scientific thought more than anything else has been the computer, the high speed computer. Because I remember as a graduate student when I was interested in theoretical problems in biology, I would try and set them up, and I always came to the same insoluble set of second order nonlinear differential equations, and there was just nothing to do. And once there were computers, there was a lot to do. And I think there's a lot of things like that where that has really change the. I have one story to tell you. I was once setting up a meeting on bioinformatics, and at George Mason, and so we put an ad in Nature announcing the magazine. When that issue of Nature came out, I got three emails: one from New Zealand, one from England, and one from Israel. And I said, Teilhard's noosphere.
Teilhard Chardin. Right?
Yeah, the mind encircling the planet. As I say, they happen to have come from New Zealand, Israel, and England. And again, I think that's part of the computer revolution.
Yeah. If you hadn't been a scientist, can you imagine what other direction you might have gone into? What else would you have liked to have been?
Well, I was on my way to graduate school in a field other than science. I majored in physics and philosophy as an undergraduate. And I was on my way to graduate school in philosophy to study the philosophy of science. And that summer between graduation and graduate school, I had a job driving a truck, so I had a lot of chance to think. And it just hit me that progress in philosophy came maybe every 50-100 years, whereas it looked like biophysics and biochemistry, a lot was going to happen in a big hurry. And that sort of. So it would have been science in another aspect of it.
Well, philosophy of science. Yeah, although as you know, if you find some pretty hardcore scientists here, they'll as soon as you use the P word, philosophy, they get rather alarmed.
But again, I think that's a change. I suspect those who get alarmed by the P word are all over 60.
So,
I may be wrong, but.
So did you followed through since then the debates between Kuhn and Popper and the
yes,
entire direction?
Yes, and I'm actually back now. The group I'm at the George Mason, I'm giving a course on philosophical foundations of neuroscience, where it's very important because these, you know, very good young graduate students have to face the question, if you knew every neuron and every synapse and every action potential, would you know what consciousness was?
So you're doing neuroscience? You started
Well, the institute I'm in for various historical reasons, is a neuroscience institute. No, I'm still working on the origin of life, but or as I would tell them, the first emergent step to neuroscience. I tell them about glutamic acid. And
right.
That's why I'm a neuroscientist.
Did you have a favorite, sort of a philosopher? I mean, is there a philosopher that you read with, who was the philosopher that you read with the most enjoyment and reward, let me say?
Actually, he was a mentor of mine who had taught philosophy at Yale, Henry Margonow. I don't know if you know
him.
Yes,
of course.
Very distinguished physicist.
Yes.
But who also wrote the book Physical Reality, which I still find one of the best introductions to the philosophy of science. And that leads you back to take Immanuel Kant very seriously.
Well, but we did a meeting, one of the original meetings at the Science Network
right.
We did was called Beyond Belief, and we had a poster there, which was a piece of art which was done by Anselm Kiefer. It's actually Kiefer himself lying on the ground, parched landscape, with a huge vault of the heavens above him. There's a star coming down to his eye and so on. And the reason I actually asked Kiefer if we could use that piece of art, the reason being that the line from Kant about the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me.
Right.
That became a great debating point, obviously, because we were talking about neuroethics, we were talking about law, we were talking about morality. And plainly, a lot of the philosophers nowadays would say that morality was not something that was within me, and indeed is something that you acquire, and so on. So Kant is not a great favorite with neuroscientists at all.
That may be, but the thing that's, I find, he should be, because his epistemology in the Critique of Pure Reason, because he starts out with the talking about the, what I would call the a priori and the a posteriori. The a priori is what the mind brings to the observation, and the a posteriori is what the observation brings to the mind. But the core of building a science and an epistemology depends on the mind. So the hard-nosed billiard ball scientists who don't like the P word have not, I think, really considered what Kant had to say and faced up to the fact that what you start with are phenomenology. And again, what the mind brings to the phenomenon, what the phenomenon brings to the mind. So that's what, it was in reading Margonow that I realized what Kant was really about in that, and I still feel that's an important place to start.
So Kant, as a philosopher, I understand. What about Spinoza? I would have thought that'd be somebody that you'd be interested in.
All right. So I do have a firm recollection about that. Yes, I am interested in Spinoza, although he has not been nearly as helpful as Kant. But in this one time, After I had been a professional witness on the science creation trial, I was being deposed for a trial about to take place in Louisiana on the same issue. And I was being deposed in New York City, and this very distinguished lawyer from New Orleans was up, and he was deposing me. And he said, "Dr. Morowitz, what are your religious beliefs?" And I sort of looked at the lawyer representing the ACLU, and he said, "Yeah, you have to tell him." So I said, "Well," I said, "you know, I was brought up in a certain tradition." He said, "I didn't ask you that, Dr. Morowitz." I said, "What are your religious beliefs?" So I looked at him and I said, "Oh, I'm a pantheist in the tradition of Spinoza." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, as only a lawyer from New Orleans could have made that well last for 2 minutes." Well, I could see his mind was whirring around. And he said, "Does that mean you're an atheist?" And I said, "No, sir, I'm a pantheist in the tradition of Spinoza." And we went off to an entirely different line of questioning. So, yes, that was my last official connection with Spinoza.
Einstein, I believe, gave much a similar response.
But I think that's where I think I had must have gotten it from having read Einstein. I thought about it afterward, and I thought perhaps I should have said a pantheist in the tradition of Bruno, that he paid a higher price for his pantheism. But
don't,
anyway,
don't even suggest being burned at the stake in these situations. It would not be good.
Okay. And anyway, that was my last official contact with a view of Spinoza.
Do you have any plans to write a book on philosophy?
No, not immediately. But you know, writing books is somewhat habit forming.
You've done a lot of that, and may you write many more. It was great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you.